mantle of Sheikh. After Mahir had been killed, along with two others, it had left only Ariz's father, who barely escaped with his life. His father's wounds were many, however, and became infected. They delivered him to the farther fields 3 days into their journey, leaving Ariz with more responsibility than he could handle. As young as Ariz was, he was no fool. His question showed more wisdom than men twice his age might show. Onur's ships were distant yet. It was likely they hadn't spotted the 13th tribe, but if they continued on their present course, they surely would. Which would place the whole of tribe Kianat in danger. Emery looked again to the Kianat ships, sails down, anchored for the night. He couldn't allow Onur to catch them unaware.
Here's what we'll do.
As Emre laid out his plan, Ariz fidgeted. He looked to the stocky Ali Budrek, but also to Shalalara, another he had come to trust for her shrewd opinions and, not inconsequentially, Emre suspected, the winks and lewd jokes she directed at him. Ariz seemed nervous, even scared, but by the time Emre was done, a hopefulness, almost eagerness, had displaced some of the fear. Emre was proud of him.
It will serve you well over the course of the coming day, he thought.
Ali Budrak nodded his agreement with Emre's plan, though not without some reservation showing on his dour face. Shalalara did as well. Hadad remained silent, but when Ariz asked for her opinion, she gave her assent and pledged her ship to aid in the effort. In the end, Ariz agreed, and soon their ragtag fleet had begun maneuvering in a grand arc southward. All except for one, the Widow's Scythe, a cutter, and their fastest ship, sped in the opposite direction on full sail, making for the huddled ships of the 13th tribe. Chapter 52. On the night following the battle at Sasha's temple, Meriem summoned Ramad to her apartments. When he arrived, she was curled crookedly in her padded chair, leaning over her desk as a fire roared nearby, fending off the cold of the night.
"My queen,"
he said, standing in the doorway.
"Come."
She summoned him with a perfunctory wave, hardly taking her eyes from the extensive letter she was writing. Despite the fire, she shivered enough to make her hand quiver as she wrote. More concerning, however, was the fact that she was wearing the amulet again. The outer doors were open, revealing the sapphire in its gilded cage.
"You'll catch your death,"
Ramad said as he headed across the room to close the windows.
"I enjoy the night breeze."
"You're not yet recovered, Meriem."
"My queen."
"You're not yet recovered, my queen."
Meriem slapped the ebony quill down on the table. Ink splattered over the papyrus and the leather blotter beneath it.
"I would think after all these years you'd trust me to take care of my body, Ramad."
"I would think after all these years you'd recognize when you're pushing yourself too far. Look at you. You're breathing hard, doing nothing more than writing. Khamzakir is gone. So is Guldrathen. We're safe for a time."
"We are anything but safe. The moment we accepted Kiral's summons to Eventide, we entered into a silent war. It's only a matter of time before it escalates."
"All the more reason not to expend yourself too soon."
Emotions warred on her face as she stared at him. She put visible effort into stifling it, however, and picked up her quill once more.
"I need you to deliver this letter to the Enclave."
The Enclave was not a place, but rather a fellowship of other magi. Meriem had long ago reached out to those in Sharakai with abilities like hers, first and foremost so that she wouldn't be considered an enemy, but also to share in their vow of mutual protection from the kings and other threats.
"Chichio can go.
I've sent Chichio and Vrago to fetch supplies.
Then I'll give it to Amaryllis.
Given the recent events, this is too important. I would have you do it, Ramad.
Very well. Where this time?
The locations of drops like these changed weekly, sometimes daily, following the whims of the Enclave's members.
Hog's Hollow.
Hog's Hollow was an oud parlour on the quay on the Western Harbour, a favourite of the Sandsmen. Most called it the Hog, others Hog Swallow, as only pigs would eat the swill that came from their kitchen. It was as distant and inconvenient a location as could have been chosen. Even on horseback, he had been gone for well over an hour, but they had agreed to avoid using horses for such trips. They were a rarity in most quarters of the city and attracted too much attention. When Miriam finished writing, she blew on the ink, rolled the scroll up, and applied a green wax, melting it with heat from the tip of her finger. That done, she pressed the seal of Chimer into it. The entire time her hands trembled. Ramad accepted the scroll, bowing his head to her.
Anything else?
That's all.
Before I go, my queen, might I ask you to close the doors of the amulet?
A quizzical look came over her. She stared down as if she were surprised to find it open.
I'll do as I please.
Miriam, that gem is nothing to toy with. We agreed you'd only open it if it was important, if it was necessary.
This time she showed no irritation at the use of her name.
So we did, she said, clipping the doors closed. Are you pleased now?
I won't be pleased until that infernal device has been removed from our lives.
This device is going to lift our country to heights it has never seen, Ramad.
I would like nothing more, but even you must admit that it could just as easily ruin us.
Miriam practically fell back into her chair, as if she couldn't pretend to be nice any longer.
Go, Ramad! Return to me when you're done.
Basilio was waiting outside Mariam's rooms as Ramad left. He watched Ramad with a satisfied smirk. Ramad stopped and turned to him.
Do you have anything to say?
Me?
Basilio said. Of course not, my lord, and please.
He bowed and waved toward the door that led to the stables.
I wouldn't dream of keeping you.
Ramad turned and left, leaving Basilio to his smugness.
I will take a horse, Ramad decided.
He was still concerned over being discreet, but there was a tavern along the trough whose owner was a Chimerian emigre. He would put up Ramad's horse and let him slip out the back with no questions asked. As he rode through the gates of the embassy house, however, and the pikeman in their royal livery nodded to him, he began to wonder at Miriam's attitude. Why send him? He wasn't above it, but she'd acted as though it were imperative that Ramad be the one to go. Add that to Basilio's self-satisfied reaction to his leaving, as well as Vrago and Ciccio being conveniently away, and Ramad soon found himself reining his horse to a stop. He turned to look back at the embassy's dark profile. It was lit strangely in the light of dusk, like a burning ember about to be extinguished. He kicked his horse into a trot, heading back the way he had come. He knew what he was about to do was a small betrayal, but he had learned long ago to trust his instincts. As one travelled along the King's Road, there were a smattering of small embassies from distant lands, each little more than a cluster of small buildings. Residences, stables, a barracks for the soldiers who protect foreign dignitaries. The four primary houses, however, Chimeres, Mireas, Malasans, Kunduns, were more impressive, with surrounding walls, larger estates and stables, and barracks to house larger contingents of soldiers. Before he came near the Chimeri compound, Ramad guided his horse off the road, and spurred it over a low hill to reach an orchard. The There was little chance of being discovered. The orchard backed up to a small manor, abandoned for over a year after the previous ambassador, a man from a tiny country east of Malasan, had been hung for bedding one of the king's married daughters. Ramad continued beyond the northern border of the estate and made for a hill where an ancient watchtower stood. The tower, too, was abandoned by all but a few children who lived nearby. But it was empty now. The perfect place to keep an eye on the entrance of the Khaimiri embassy house. Behind the compound, obscuring much of the city, loomed the curtain wall that surrounded the whole of the House of Kings. Beyond lay the southern expanse of the city, where the huge mansions and sprawling green estates of Golden Hill gave way to the progressively smaller, though still wealthy, manors of Blackfire Gate and Hanging Gardens. He waited as the sun set, giving way to starlight and Rhea's dim crescent. He was beginning to feel embarrassed as the minutes passed, increasingly sure it had only been paranoia that had driven him here. But then, a coach pulled by two horses came rumbling down King's Road from the direction of the palaces. It slowed before the Khaimiri Embassy House and was let in. Through the iron gates, Ramad could see the coach pull around the carriage circle and come to a stop before the doors. The driver dropped down. Two maidens riding on the rear of the coach hopped off and followed. The rest was lost to darkness. Ramad felt a strange numbness running through him. He and Meriem had been through much. Years spent in Khaimir before the Bloody Passage. Years more in Sharakai hunting Masid, the one responsible for the murder of his wife and child and dozens of others. The months they had spent in Villarosa and then their return to the desert as pawns of Hamzakir. The two of them were often at odds over this or that, but he had never thought that Meriem would distrust him. Did she question his loyalty to Khaimir? His loyalty to her? Or was her apparent distrust merely an indicator that she wanted to keep certain things secret from as many people as possible for as long as possible? He might have believed the last had she not sent his most trusted men away on the same night. Mighty Alu, the thought of Meriem trusting Basilio more than himself made his blood boil. He was tempted to ride through the main gate, order anyone who saw him to look the other way. Queen's business, he might tell them, and confront her. But they may have received orders to stop him should he return, and there was no telling what the maidens might do should he arrive uninvited. So instead, he left his horse tied to a bush behind the tower and ran quick and low down the hill, to head for the place where the embassy house wall intersected with the king's larger curtain wall. The wall itself was made of sandstone and had iron spikes along the top. A thick bush growing at the base of the wall caught his clothes in its branches as he slipped past it, and there, hidden away, was a steel door, an escape route created generations ago, and a portal to which only a select few had keys. Ramad took his from the small pouch at his belt and fit it into the lock. It took some doing, but the lock was oiled several times a year and eventually turned over. He pulled the door open slowly. The ensuing creak sounded as loud as the great horns used to announce the kings on festival days, and yet no cry of alarm was raised, and he heard no signs of approach. Once inside the grounds, he studied the darkened yard, the stables and paddock to his left. The guest house and the servants' quarters nestled along the far wall. To his right, the towering bulk of the mansion stared down. Various lamps from within made it look like the head of a desert titan, its many eyes alight in anger. He sped quietly across the carriage path leading to the front of the estate, slipped over a low garden wall and used a trellis to reach the second floor. After one last climb along a drainpipe, he reached the patio outside Meriem's apartments. He rather suspected that for a meeting such as this, Meriem would avoid the audience room on the first floor. Indeed, as he came nearer to the patio doors, he heard voices. Meriem's soft tones and Kiral's baritone, both of which were difficult to hear. He wondered, though, why not meet in Eventide? It seemed likely Kiral was trying to hide something. But from whom? People in his own palace? The King of Whispers?
"You promise me Hamzakir's head on a platter,"
Kiral was saying as Ramad crouched near the doors.
"And you will have it."
"So you say, but our trap was sprung too soon."
Ramad leaned closer to the door and peered between the curtains. Meriem was seated in her opulent silver chair, her back to the door so that Ramad could see only her right arm along the armrest. Kiral sat opposite her in the chair Ramad often took while in discussion with Meriem. The fire in the hearth threw wavering light against his rich clothes. His closely shorn hair, his stark, pockmarked face. His eyes sparked like flint, as unamused as crumbling granite.
"The element of surprise is now lost, true. But there's little danger to us just yet. I was able to sense him as he fled east of the city and into the desert."
"Little danger," Kiral countered. "He may have returned since then. He may be in the city now, waiting for his time to strike. To steal into Eventide, to slit my throat. I would if I were him."
"There's little Hamzakir fears. But he fears Guldrathen greatly, and now he knows that Guldrathen has found a way to steal into Sharakai."
Meriem's fingers scratched at a stitch in the embroidery of her chair, then brushed something invisible away.
"No, I feel certain Hamzakir will remain in the desert. He doesn't know what you've told the other kings. His fears of the tide turning against him will have grown by the hour."
"Then what do you propose?"
"He'll move to secure power in the desert in any way he can. He has allies in the tribes, but most are too spread out for his purposes."
"Except to the east."
"Except to the east,"
Meriem echoed.
"The very direction Hamzakir fled. Honor has already gathered several thousand spears to his banner. More may soon follow. If Hamzakir can come to an accord with Honor, or dominate him, as he did me, he would have a base for power that Sharakai and all four kingdoms should rightly fear."
Kiral considered this.
"What you say seems likely, but it will cement his power, making it all the more difficult for you to kill him."
"True, but what does an Erek care for that? Guldrathen is still our best chance at bringing Hamzakir down."
"Unless you're planning to send Lord Amansir to stand by Onur's side, we no longer have a means of luring Guldrathen to him."
"Another lure might be fashioned," Meriem said. "Have you brought Chedamin's blood?"
Ramad started at the mention of Cheda's name.
"Breath of the desert, what does any of this have to do with her?" "I have brought it. But how might she be used as a lure?"
"Cheda has escaped the House of Kings," Meriem replied. "Where do you think she'll go now?"
Kiral adjusted in his seat.
"She'll return to her people in the desert."
"Exactly. And where do you suppose Honor will go next? Will he sail for Sharakai to begin his improbable conquest? Or will he face the smaller threat along his flank before it becomes a larger one?"
As Kiral's jaw worked, deep shadows cascaded over his cheeks.
"It would need to be coordinated so that Cheddar and Hamzakir are together when you summon the Erek."
"True to a degree. But no great amount of accuracy will be required.
As long as the two of them are within a few leagues of one another, Guldraðr will sense Hamzak here and change course. You're certain? Reasonably. But even if we've erred, Guldraðr will drink Chedamin's blood, and you'll have rid yourself of a different problem. She's hardly the threat Hamzakir is. No, not yet. But we both know she'll become more powerful as time passes. She is Ishag's granddaughter, Masid's niece, and her own legend is growing. There are many who revere her name, telling tales of how she killed two of the Sharikani kings. And you know how tales grow in the telling. She's smart, she's charismatic. She'll learn to use both to gather more to her cause. Before long, she may draw more to the Moonless Host's cause than Ishak. That may all be true, Keral said as he rose. But it's a problem for another day. He pulled two glass ampules from inside his kalat, one filled with a bright red liquid, the other with a liquid so dark it looked black in the firelight. Jader's blood, he said, handing her the red ampule. Taken while she was unconscious in Sukru's palace. And the Erex, he handed her the second, collected from Sanshira. Both by the hand of my master alchemist. Ramad's chest went cold as Miriam held the red ampule up to the firelight and swirled it around. It felt as if his heart were plunging into a deep, dark hole, threatening to take him with it. He'd known from the moment he had agreed to Guldrathan's request that he had stepped into a raging river, but he had never had thought Miriam would be the one to shove him below the surface.
And the elixirs?
Miriam went on.
They were found in the temple's lower level, were they not?
Keral frowned.
They were.
And where are they now?
In safekeeping. Expect no share of them until Hamzakir and Guldraðr are both dead.
The beast was not part of our bargain.
I was forced to attack it to save your man. I may not know much about the Erech, but I know they neither forgive nor forget. This is a complication you must deal with before I part with any of the elixirs.
Very well. Then 50 more must be added to the tally, Miriam said in a tone that did not allow for negotiation.
They were speaking of the life-giving elixirs Ramad had helped to destroy in Keral's palace. Kiral's and Isan's primary caches had been destroyed, but the Moonless Host's plan for the third and final cache, the one in Zaheb's palace, had been compromised. Hamzakir and his men had beaten them there. What they couldn't take, they'd destroyed, leaving precious few in each of the king's personal stores. From what Ramad had been able to piece together, Kiral had been dangling a throne before Hamzakir, that of Kulishan, the wandering king, Hamzakir's father. In order to get some of the elixirs back. In turn, Hamzakir had done much to destroy the power of the Moonless Host's old guard, both in Sharakai and in the desert. But Kiral would not have let it go at that. He wanted immortality, or as much of it as he could get his hands around. Now, it seemed, he had secured some in the form of the elixirs. Likely he had not told the other kings about it, which would explain his presence here.
50,
Kiral said, practically spitting the words. He motioned to the ampules.
We've received word that Onur has killed Mihir Halimava and taken many from tribe Kadri prisoner. The rest are scattered to the winds. If we are to do as you've said, we must leave soon.
Miriam considered a moment.
I can leave tomorrow if you wish.
Prepare for the morning after. A coach will be sent at daybreak.
Very well.
Kiral glanced toward the door through which Ramad was peering. Ramad jerked out of view and went perfectly still. listening carefully for the sounds of approach. A moment later, Kiral's heavy footsteps thudded over the carpeted floor, diminishing as they went.
My Lady Queen.
My Lord King.
As the door clicked shut, the words echoed through Ramad's mind.
I can leave tomorrow if you wish.
It made him deadly curious what Meriem had written in her note. He cracked the seal and read it by the dim light from Meriem's room. Written below a request for a number of rare components was a simple closing note.
I'll be leaving the city soon, but will require them upon my return.
She had known Kiral would be leaving for the desert. He heard the doors at the front of the estate being opened. Footsteps crunched over gravel. Soon after came the clomp of horses' hooves and the rattle of wheels. He ducked low as the carriage swept through the gate and turned right, making for the king's palaces. When the sounds had dwindled and the wagon was swallowed by the night, Ramad stood and dropped the papyrus scroll on the roof. The wind rolled it away as he opened the patio door and stepped inside. Meriem, standing near the fire, turned, her eyes wide, her hand on the amulet at her neck. As recognition came, her look of surprise faded, replaced by a low, burning anger. The sort Ramad hadn't seen in a long while. Rather than making him nervous, it calmed him. It seemed only right, after all. It matched his own, and this reckoning had been a long time coming.
You would use Chaedir as your pawn.
You would rather I use you?
Yes.
Well, it's no longer a choice that's up to you. Your sentimentality will get you killed one day, Ramad.
I deserve to know, Meriem.
You will refer to me as my queen, or I'll have you whipped until you remember to treat me with respect before you open that insolent mouth of yours.
I deserved to know.
I can't explain all to you. You are but part of...
I am not talking about my role as a servant to the throne.
Her hollow eyes took him in anew.
What? You think because you've wedded me that I owe you more?
For that? For what we've meant to one another before then. For Yasmin and Rehan.
Don't bring my sister into this. They're gone and buried. I love them. But they do not rule Chimir. I do. And I will do what I think best. I will do what's necessary to see us safely through the night.
Safely through the night? Ramad wanted to laugh. Were that true? You'd have left Sharakai for the halls of Santrion long ago. Instead, I see you hurtling through the darkness as if you're being chased, heedless of what lies ahead, and with little thought for what's best for Chimir. Admit it, Meriem. This has all been for you.
He waved toward the doors he'd just walked through.
This is because you look to Toriad, and you see jewels lying upon a hill. Baubles to be collected.
Whosoever ruled Sharakai is a threat to our homeland.
Hunger now mixed with Meriem's anger.
Unless we take it for ourselves, Ramad.
The risk is too great.
The gods favor the bold
and punish the foolish.
Strangely, Ramad's heart beat serenely. It was Meriem who was breathing fast, nostrils flaring, her eyes filling with ever more anger. Just then Basilio opened the door.
My queen!
He paused, shocked to find Ramad standing there. He immediately began bullying toward him, but stopped when Ramad drew his shamshir.
You dare!
Basilio said. Ramad ignored him.
Take me, Meriem. Leave Chaedir alone.
Meriem raised her hand, forestalling Basilio without taking her eyes from Ramad.
What do you care if some bitch from the back streets of Sharakai is lost to a creature like Gudraven?
Take me.
Meriem's eyes, so emotional only moments ago, went flat, dangerous, no different than a mongoose before it struck.
Or what?
The moment Meriem moved her hand toward her necklace, Ramad was ready. He snatched it and yanked, snapping the chain. She cringed as the chain bit into her neck. The droplets of blood welling over her pale skin stood out like an accusation. But Ramad hardly noticed. He was trying to stifle the feelings of lightheadedness emanating from the amulet. He could feel it calling to someone, not him. Not Meriem either. Someone else. Someone nearby. Without looking at it, he closed the amulet's lead-lined doors, felt them click into place. Immediately the feeling ceased.
You think I need the amulet?
Meriem ran one finger over the blood on her neck, then ran it over her tongue, painting it red.
You think you can stop me from doing as I wish?
Ramad felt it coming. He tried to stop her. He thought he was prepared, but this was nothing like when he had stopped Hamzakir from unleashing arcane fire on Guldrathan. That had been deliberate and careful and practiced. What came from Meriem was wild, like the great waves that sometimes struck the coast of the Austral Sea without warning and with unstoppable force.
Meriem!
He wanted to plead with her, but the pain came on so strong, so quickly, he was driven down by it. He collapsed to the floor. The last thing he saw was Meriem standing over him, Basilio by her side.
Take him to the desert,
Meriem said as the world began to close in around him.
And then, my queen, bury him.
Chapter 53. Brahma crouched behind a veil-choked pagoda as Lord Ramad Amansir, the very man who'd stolen Rumayesh's sapphire and run his blade across Brahma's throat for good measure, knelt on the stones of the patio only a dozen paces away. And that wasn't the strangest thing. The strangest thing was that the man appeared to be spying on his own queen. The queen was taking counsel with none other than the King of Kings. From what little Brahma could hear, the two were discussing a slaughter in the temple district. Kiral himself had been present, as had Hamzakir, the infamous blood mage. Most surprising, however, was a new name to Brahma, Guldrathan.
An Irek, Brahma realized as they shared more details. Another Irek. Here in Sharakai.
It can't have been a coincidence that the battle they were discussing had taken place mere days after Rumayesh had been stolen from Brahma. What the connection might be, he had no idea. But Kiral sounded displeased. There'd been a great deal of destruction, and Kiral himself had been wounded.
It must have just happened then. Today, perhaps yesterday.
It would explain why he had heard nothing of it. He had been hiding in the old abandoned watchtower the past 4 days, watching the Chimeri compound, noting the number of guards and other household staff, watching their comings and goings, estimating their readiness as he planned his entry. After seeing how many had been sent into the city earlier that day, Brahma had decided tonight would be the night. And then, lo and behold, Ramad Amansir himself had ridden up to the very watchtower where Brahma hid and began surveilling his own bloody compound. After the king arrived, Amansir had abandoned the tower and stolen into the compound by means of a secret door, making Brahma's entry simpler than he could ever have hoped.
Brahma! I suffer! Trapped in the cage she's made for me! Why won't you come? Why won't you save me?
There were Rumayesh's faint pleas. She had called to him whenever Queen Meriem was most distracted. She had pleaded for him to storm the room and save her, but he could hardly barge in and try to seize the sapphire now, not with Kiral and his bloody great Shamshir there, not with two blade maidens wandering somewhere inside the estate. And yet, every moment that passed brought him closer to throwing caution to the wind. Rumayesh's need was great, and it burned inside Brahma too. Twice he had found himself rising, ready to slit Amansir's throat and break into the room. Logic and reason be damned. The very notion of helping Rumayesh, a creature who had done him so much harm, nearly made him weep. His continued horror over being here, doing that very thing, was all that had allowed him to remain where he was and wait for the right moment.
"The perfect moment will never come,"
Rumayesh cooed.
"Take the amulet, Brahma, and then I will be free. Take the amulet and none of them can stop us."
Brahma gritted his teeth, fighting the urge to obey. The conversation finally ended, and the king left with his maidens in the wagon. When the sound of their departure faded, Amansir stood and walked into the room like a man made of wood. The need inside Brahma finally eased as he sidled along the patio's edge. One of the doors was ajar, allowing Brahma to see Amansir and his queen. The two of them were shouting,
"Come, Brahma. She is powerful, but she cannot suffer the kiss of a blade. Save me, and we can be together once more."
He found himself stepping forward, heedless of the scraping sound his boots made over the stone tiles. He drew his kenshar from his belt. Powerful, Rumayesh had said of Queen Meriem. Perhaps she was, but by Baki's bright hammer, the woman was gaunt. Her entire body quavered, the same sort of shaking he had seen on malnourished children in the shallows. He could see the sapphire resting in an amulet around the queen's narrow neck. It would be so simple to take it. Two flicks of his knife, one across her throat, another across Amansir's, and then he'd slip the chain over the queen's head and around his, where it belonged.
"Yes! Yes!"
He could feel the eagerness in Rumayesh, a perfect mirror of his own.
"They've not sensed you. Rush in, do it now. We can flee this place and everything will be as it was."
He was standing just outside the door now. If either of them turned their heads, they'd see him plain as day. He was just reaching for the handle of the door, ready to do as Rumayesh had commanded, when Amansir reached out and snatched the necklace from his queen's neck. He gripped the amulet, closed its doors, and Rumayesh's presence vanished. Her sudden absence tugged on Brahma's soul. He put his hand over his mouth, trying to stifle the sudden cough that overtook him, but the queen was raging against Amansir.
"You think I need the amulet? You think you can stop me from doing as I wish?"
Amansir, his face turning red, fell to his knees, then dropped to the floor, unconscious. A portly Kaimiri lord in ostentatious clothes had arrived, just when Brahma wasn't sure.
"Take him to the desert," she told the man.
"And then, my queen?"
"Bury him."
The queen retrieved the amulet from Amansir's lax grip.
"Do it now before Chichio and Vrago return, and take him in the back of a wagon. I'll have no one else knowing of it."
When the man bowed his head and left, the queen pulled the necklace back over her head, but did not open the doors that would reveal the sapphire. Brahma couldn't decide whether he was glad for it or not. He wished to bask in Rumayesh's glow, even if she was trapped, but another part of him was sickened by the very thought. He was suddenly afraid of stepping into the room. He felt as though without Rumayesh's power he had been defenseless, and the queen would do to him exactly what she had done to her own man. And the more he focused on it, the worse it became. It felt very much like the day he had first stood before Rumayesh. Gods, the feeling of dread that had stolen over him. His thoughts were broken as the portly lord returned with two men. One of the men wore mud-stained trousers and a dark shirt. The other wore a stained cook's apron. With their queen watching on with a strangely casual air, the three of them picked Amansia up and carried him from the room. Brahma nearly charged in then, but his fear got the better of him as Queen Meriem noticed the door. She moved forward and shut it with a soft clatter as Brahma backed away. A moment later, a wagon pulled out from the stables and drove toward the rear of the estate.
Amansir, Brahma decided. He'll know more about the queen than anyone, and he has reason to want to be rid of the sapphire.
Brahma moved to the edge of the patio as a door opened and the fop, the cook, and the man Brahma assumed was the groundsman all shuffled out. The driver was an old, crooked man, wearing a floppy hat. He opened the door to the carriage while the others carried Amansir's unconscious form toward it. They grunted and manhandled him onto the floor of the cabin, shoved his legs unceremoniously inside, then kicked the door shut, trapping him within.
"Kill him now!" the portly lord said.
"Here, my lord," the cook was saying.
"He'll bleed all over the carriage,"
the driver complained in a low, gruff voice. The portly lord stared between all three of them and finally rasped,
"Mighty Alu, take him away then. Do it in the desert as your queen bade you."
Brahma's mind was beginning to race. If he let them leave, there'd be no catching up. He stared at the carriage as the men continued to talk. The gate had been opened for the king and had yet to be closed.
"Gods, what am I doing?"
Before he could change his mind, he slipped over the railing. If he could reach the roof below, he could drop down onto the carriage.
"It will be done," one of the men said gruffly, "though I don't see why we have to do it. I'm not a fucking headsman."
As the driver climbed up to the bench and made way for the groundskeeper to join him, Brahma moved quick as a goat along a mountainside, the sides of his soft boots tiptoeing along the narrow stone lip. He hurtled as far as he dared, then launched himself at the team of horses. He landed on the wagon shaft between them, startling both. They bolted into a run. The driver's eyes went wide as teacups. He shouted and jerked backward in fright, losing the reins in the process. He tried to grab for them a moment later, but Brahma gave them a tug and he missed.
"Now! Now!" Brahma said. "I need those!"
"Thief!"
the fat lord shouted.
"Thief!"
The groundskeeper had made it halfway up to the driver's bench.
"Don't know who you are," he said. "But you've made yourself a terrible mistake."
He finished the climb and reached for his machete in its sheath along his thigh. Brahma, meanwhile, climbed onto the rear of the galloping horse, leapt for the bench and drove his knife straight into the man's throat. He shoved him aside and he fell off the wagon with an unceremonious thump.
"Who the bloody hell are you?"
the driver asked, shifting as far away as he could on the bench.
"Haven't you heard?"
Brahma said, brandishing his bloody blade.
"I'm the king's new barber. Now get off this coach before I slice you up."
The man's hands lifted.
"I want no trouble, my lord."
"Then I imagine you know what to do."
Brahma pointed his knife over the side of the carriage, which was now hurtling toward the front gates, and the man took the hint. He leapt free, and Brahma heard a grunt above the jingle of tack and the raucous rattle of the wheels. Ahead, along the top of the walls, a pair of guards were closing in toward the gates, but the coach would be passed before they could swing either of them shut. They saw it too and stopped where they were to lift something to their shoulders. Brahma ducked low as he flew through the open gates. A crossbow bolt thudded into the bench beside him. Another burst through the meat of his right leg. A roar of pain managed to escape him before he bit down on the pain. He pulled left on the reins, snapping them hard against horses' flanks to keep them moving fast. As they turned, Brahma sucked air through clenched teeth and glanced over his shoulder. A third crossbow bolt thunked into the roof of the cabin just behind him. He might have heard something flutter through the air above him. By then, the bulk of the Araba shielded him. But it did little to ease Brahma's worries. Blood was running from the wound to his leg. The bolt was at an awkward angle, entering halfway down his thigh and exiting just behind his knee. To even touch it brought a searing pain. In his earliest days with Rumayesh, Brahma would try to hide from the pain she dealt him, but he'd found over and over again that hiding made it worse. The only way through the pain was to accept it, but not so much that he embraced it. He had learned to walk the line between awareness and fear. Only then was he unmoved by it. As he had 1,000 times before, he balanced along that knife's edge. He calmed his breathing, unclenched his jaw, and snapped the shaft of the crossbow bolt. As he pulled it through from the opposite side, he felt it tug the skin along the outside of his leg, felt the shaft scrape through muscle, felt the skin near the inside of his knee grip as the shaft came free. The pain flared and then slowly diminished, but he treated it no differently. The pain was. He was. More worrisome was the feeling of lightheadedness. Fall unconscious now, and it might mean both his life and Amansir's. As the horses galloped along King's Road, the flow of blood eased and the stars in his eyes faded.
"Now what, you bloody fool?"
The guards he had left behind would be after him soon enough. And ahead lay the House of Maidens, which he'd have to pass through to reach the safety of the city streets. The maidens would never let him pass unchallenged, not with an unconscious Chimeri lord in the cabin and his leg bleeding as though he were fleeing a battle. At the very least, they'd question him, which would give Queen Meriem's men more than enough time to catch up. After passing several more embassy houses, he pulled the horses to a stop. There might be some clothes in the cabin or the trunk strapped to the back. He could prop Amansir up on one of the benches and pretend the man was drunk. He might even find a bit of brandy or a rack hidden away to help. And he could fake a Chimeri accent well enough. He could tell the maidens his lord had ordered Brahma to take him into the city. It happened often enough. The lords and ladies of embassies grew bored and could often be found in many of the shisha dens along the trough, spreading their money around. He had just lowered himself gingerly down to the ground, convinced he could make this work, when he realized there was no one in the cabin. It was empty. He looked back along the King's Road, surveying the moonlit landscape to see if the man had somehow managed to throw himself free, but there was nothing.
"Nalame's pendulous teats, where have you gone?"
"Right here," came a hoarse voice.
Brahma spun to find Amansir standing there. He was holding a knife to Brahma's throat.
"You don't want to do that," Brahma said,
his arms held openly at his sides, his eyes glancing down toward the knife. Amansir coughed, his brows pinched.
"Don't I?"
"Wouldn't you rather?"
Brahma jutted his chin toward the walls and towers of the House of Maidens.
"Escape into Sharakai. Before your queen's men recapture you. Or worse, before she comes herself rather than leave it to the incompetents who allowed me to rescue you."
"Rescue me?"
"Just so.
I tried to bloody kill you, why would you?"
His words trailed off as his eyes shifted to something over Brahma's shoulder. Shouts were coming from the embassy house.
"If we're lucky," Brahma went on, "they'll need a few moments more before they ride out to find us. If not..."
He left the rest unsaid, and Amansir took the hint. He looked back toward the House of Maidens.
"Get inside," he said. "Quickly."
He hopped up to the driver's bench, pulled free the crossbow bolt embedded in the wood of the bench, then tossed it into the darkness. Brahma did the same with the bolt on the roof, then slipped inside the cabin. The Araba began to move a moment later.
"Look out!"
Amansir called back.
"That's hardly difficult, my lord."
"And that's drunk, but don't say a word, even if they ask you a direct question."
"And if they take a cudgel to me?"
"Keep acting like a jackanape, and we're both going to learn what the bite of ebon steel feels like." "The same as any other blade, no doubt."
The Araba soon approached the House of Maidens. When they halted at the gates, a blade maiden approached, her black turban and veil hiding all but her eyes.
"My lord Amansir," she said. "Late business?"
"Grim business, I'm afraid. Our physic is traipsing about in Sharakai, and one of my men managed to take a length of steel to his thigh."
The maiden glanced inside the cabin. Brahma gripped his leg and looked appropriately grim, appropriately drunk as well, though whether the combination was working, or if he just looked like a crazed idiot, he had no idea. The wound had nearly stopped bleeding, but the blood all over his woolen trousers was fresh and bright.
"Sword play?"
the maiden asked.
"My idiot marshal downed an entire bottle of Chimere's finest and decided that trading blows with the smith's son would make for a fine bit of entertainment."
"Let me guess.
The smith was also drunk."
With a rueful smile, Amansir touched his finger to his nose. She laughed, though the look she gave Brahma held little charity. A moment later, however, her look softened, and she tipped her head to the large courtyard behind her.
"The matrons rarely tend to such things, but if it's serious, I could ask for an exception to be made."
"Ah, the House of Maidens is too kind, and I might have accepted had my queen not made it clear she wishes for Letitia and no other to tend to him."
The maiden stared at Brahma's leg. She looked as though she were about to argue, but then merely shrugged.
"Very well,"
she said, and let them through. Brahma might have heard the pounding of hooves as they rode through the gates and into the city proper, but he couldn't be sure. And then they were off, hurtling, down the spear. Chapter 54. It was the seventh day after the attack in the desert, and Chayda was changing the dressing on Dadzada's wound. Sumeya had done an admirable job, and Dadzada, once conscious, had guided Chayda to the right healing salve to help speed the healing process. Still, his collarbone had been cleaved, along with much of his shoulder muscle. Chayda guessed he'd have some, perhaps complete, immobility in his left arm for the rest of his life. Dadzada seemed to agree.
"I guess you'll have to return to my side," he said one morning as he tried to slip out of his hopelessly bloody thorb. "Milk charo like you used to.
I'd rather eat all the sand in the desert."
He'd waved over the side of the skiff.
"I've heard it tastes better over rice."
Despite herself, Chayda laughed.
"It would still taste better than that garbage you gave old men to make them regular."
"They may have detested it, but their wives loved me for it."
"Loved you? How much?"
Melis asked nonchalantly. Dadzada tipped his head, a move he immediately regretted.
"I wasn't known as the stallion of the merchant's quarter for nothing."
Chayda stared open-mouthed at Dadzada's boyish grin, while Melissa's laugh filled the warming desert air. Zaid had recovered somewhat. She was able to sit, eat, and drink, but any exertion beyond that sent her heart tumbling. Even the act of getting out of the skiff on their rare rests, or a climb to the top of a shallow dune, caused her to slow, put her hands on her knees, and take measured breaths until it had passed.
"Wipe that look from your face,"
she said to Chayda one afternoon as they were breaking down their camp and preparing to set sail. You weren't even looking at me.
I don't have to.
Slowly she stood up and turned to face Chayda.
I know the signs of patronizing concern well enough.
Her face soured the longer she looked at Chayda.
Just look at you.
With an expression of disgust, she trudged past Chayda toward the skiff.
Put the funeral shroud away, girl. I'm not ready to be given back to the desert just yet.
On the 12th day following the attack, 3 full weeks since leaving Sharakai, they spotted ships on the horizon. Though their location was roughly where they were to rendezvous with the 13th tribe, they were worried they might be Onur's ships or those of another tribe. But when they sailed close enough to see the blue pennants, although they were too distant to make out in detail, there were the telltale signs of Mount Arasal stitched in white. Chayda felt a palpable relief. Dadzada seemed to as well. But Zaid, Sumeya, and Melisse all seemed tense. They were entering the domain of Tribe Kianat, who were, for all intents and purposes, the moonless host. In the span of a month, Sumeya and Melisse had gone from respected blade maidens to traitors. Even so, Ishak might make prisoners of them. No matter what Chayda might say, he was a man of his own mind, and Zaid had spent practically her entire life within the walls of the House of Kings. She might be an ally of the host, but most would view her as an outsider, a Sharakani. Near the end of the day, as their skiff approached a circle of 3 dozen ships that had come to rest for the night, Chayda reached out to Karim, whom she had left in Salsana's care. She hoped to learn what had happened in her absence and gauge the mood of the camp before she arrived. Except, he was distant. She could sense him, but he wouldn't respond to her calls. At first, she thought he was slumbering as the Asurum did beneath Yadikara, but the closer they came to camp's edge, the more she suspected Karim was willfully veiling his mind from her. Or someone was doing it for him. Salsana had bonded with him after all. Perhaps she had taken to it faster than Chayda expected, or perhaps the answer was as simple as the passage of time and their distance from Sharakai and the kings and the other Asurum. Perhaps even distance from the compulsion the gods had placed on them. It might have allowed Karim to create a stronger bond with Salsana than he had with Chayda. After trying a while longer with no success, Chayda gave up. It seemed there was no choice but to sail into camp with no further information. They were met beyond the camp by Ishak, Masid, and several other elders, including Hamid and Darius. The sun was low. Their shadows slashed against the angles in the dunes. Many stared warily, angrily at the 5 of them. And why not? Blade maidens were reviled, and here were Sumeya, Melisse, and Chayda in black battle dresses, while Zaid wore her matron's white. Dadzada stepped forward to offer greetings, but before he could, Chayda moved past him to stand before Ishak.
These 2 maidens freed me from the House of Kings.
Ishak's expression was dour, Masid's wary. The Tower of Flesh, they called Frail Lamai, stared on with a confused look on his face. Hamid, however, looked incensed.
Have you fallen and cracked your skull, Chayda? Are you bloody mad? That's Sumeya Husamatinava, first warden, slayer of dozens of our number.
You are not wrong, Hamid, but she comes here under my protection. She and Melisse freed me from the House of Kings. They saved my life from Sumeya's own father when he came to take us back. They saved my life again when 2 blade maidens from their former hand surprised us in the desert.
Chayda felt indebted to Sumeya and Melisse for delivering her from the House of Kings. She felt grateful when they stood with her against Husamitin. But she hadn't felt the same sisterhood they had once shared. Not until now.
They know the truth about the Asurum, Chayda went on,
focusing on Ishak once more. Through me, the veil over their eyes has been lifted. They saw what happened and they recognize